I'm Jeff Eichler, the host of the Getting Unstuck Cultivating Curiosity podcast. Curiosity fuels human interactions, relationships, critical thinking, and problem solving. It is unquestionably the foundation for creativity and innovation, and therefore meaningful change. Like millions of other viewers earlier in the year, I couldn't resist the Masters of the Air miniseries, which chronicled the men of the 100th Bomb Group flying out of East Anglia, England, during World War II. I've long been a student of World War II, and particularly the air war over Europe. I knew the bombers and fighter aircraft severely depleted the German Air Force before the D-Day landings. There is no question that the loss of American, British, and Canadian lives would have been much higher on June 6th and beyond were it not for Allied air power. My guest today, Steve Snyder, takes us deep into this period again, but this time it's the story of one plane and one pilot, Steve's father. Flying on his eighth mission, Howard Snyder was shot down over Belgium. Steve's book, Shot Down, chronicles his father's experience of being shot down, protected in secret for 7 months by Belgian citizens, his joining and fighting with the French resistance, and finally, his eventual return to England. This highly readable account of the air war is an ode to Steve's father, his crew, and those who risked their lives to help him. Steve's deep research also uncovered the German pilot who shot his father down, which led to their eventual meeting. Let's join the discussion and get the details. Steve, welcome to Getting Unstuck, Cultivating Curiosity.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I'm glad to be in the show. I appreciate you inviting me.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this ever since I ran across your book and what you're doing. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and of course, one of the shows on television at that time was 12 O'Clock High, and I have been a student, let me put it that way, a student of the air war ever since. And so I'm very eager to talk to you about your dad's experience and about the air war over Europe during World War II. And just let me say, as we start here, about your book, Shot Down, that one of the things I really liked about it is that it is a memoir of your dad, but it's also just a great history of the air war in Europe. And you know, people are probably familiar with Masters of the Air, you know, the television series and Donald Miller's book, which is readable, but it's a big book. And what I liked about yours is that it's very readable and it's very concise. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I'm going to call attention to one of the things that I really love that you pointed out that I think is a big deal, but we'll wait to get there. Okay. I always start and end the podcast with questions of curiosity. That's what the show is about, is cultivating curiosity. So I get to ask you the first question. Steve, what's one thing that you are curious about?
That's a very good question. You know, I'm a very curious person, you know, and I ask questions all the time, and it irritates my wife to no end. It's like, well, why do you need to know that? But I just have a passion for knowing stuff, you know, from other people. Yeah, the first thing that came to mind, but that the decisions I've made or some things that have changed my life and what it would have been like if that hadn't happened. But really, the thing I'm most curious about really is still my father. Because although I know and am blessed to know so much about what happened to him and his crew, I probably know more about what happened to my dad than 99.9% of the children of World War II vets. But I'm still would love to know so much more because I know all the facts and what happened in detail, but I don't know, and I never really took the time to ask him or thought to ask him about how he felt about it. And when he was there, you know, what were his feelings? What was he thinking? And so I really regret that. And so that's really the thing I'm most curious about.
Yeah, I love that. I'm going to include a link to the video that you produced, to the documentary that you produced about your father and his time during World War II, being shot down during World War II. And I love that segment at the end where the interviewer asks you, you know, basically what you've just been talking about, you know, what kind of regret, and that you didn't ask your dad when you had the choice. And that to me is a learning for all of us, you know, is to ask those questions before it's too late, right?
Right. You know, because most, you know, kids grow up, or people grow up, and, you know, they're little kids, you know, you're in your own worlds, and, you know, your parents are these old people. And then, you know, you get older and you're going to college, and then you get married and you have kids, you get a job, and you're busy, busy, busy. And most people never know really about their grandparents or their parents, you know, their earlier lives. They don't know their history. And to me, that's just fascinating. And, you know, more people should talk to their parents and their grandparents and ask them about, you know, their lives and their history.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I know that my grandfather was a tailor in Chicago. I know that my dad emigrated from Poland in 1905, grew up in Chicago. And I know bits and pieces of his history, but he was a very quiet individual. And I was, of course, young at the time, and I didn't know to ask questions, you know, like you're suggesting. And there are just huge gaps in my knowledge about my dad. And it's just, you used a great word, what it's a regret, right? And I mean, I'm insanely curious, but there's nobody left in our family to ask those questions of. So,
right. Yeah. You know, because I go all over the United States doing PowerPoint presentations about my book and attending the air show, signing copies of my book, and I meet lots and lots of people. And I just hear again and again and again, you know, people come up to me and go, gosh, you know, my dad or my uncle was in World War II, but I really don't know anything about it.
Exactly.
You know? And because, you know, they didn't talk about it, or I didn't ask the question. So it's really a shame.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so let's get into it, Steve. I mentioned Masters of the Air. Some people may be familiar, you know, if they watch that series, they're going to be familiar with what we're going to be talking about. But obviously, many people didn't watch that series. This is really what we're going to be talking about, is the fact that your dad was a B-17 pilot. He flew a, I think it's a beautiful aircraft. And, you know, I've got friends who flew the B-24, and I can easily turn them into enemies, but I thought the B-17 was a beautiful aircraft. Your dad flew one. He was shot down, and that's the name of your book. So level set us here about the air war in England. What were we doing in East Anglia in the 40s?
Well, the 8th Air Force went over to England, and they flew their first mission on August 17th of 1942. And their goal was to hit industrial and military targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. They flew high altitude daylight precision bombing missions over Europe. And their objective was really twofold. You know, one is, like I say, to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. But for the U.S. to, you know, send troops over to Europe, they needed to knock out the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. And so that was another job of the 8th Air Force, was to cripple Germany's air force so the Allies had air superiority, so they could, you know, invade Normandy on D-Day and land all these landing crafts. And so they didn't have any German fighters, destroying their efforts. So that was really their mission. And at the peak, they had about 40 bomb groups in an area called East Anglia, like you mentioned, which is about the size of Vermont. And these bases were located only about 5 to 10 miles apart, and so you had thousands of airmen over there fighting the air war over Europe. And my dad was in the 306th Bomb Group. I'm president of the 306th Bomb Group Historical Association.
I know.
And the movie 12 O'Clock High was based on a true story about the 306th Bomb Group. And he arrived on October 21st with his crew and reported to the 306th. It was located at Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London.
So what was it like to be a crew, Steve? And I suspect, based on what I know, that it did change over the 3 years that they were really active, from 43 to 45, because the armaments on the B-17s changed from model to model, tell us about what it was like to be a crew member.
Okay. Yeah, there were three different models of B-17s that were flown. The definitive one is the G model with the chin turret that had 13 50 caliber machine guns. So they could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. And at the beginning of the war, like you mentioned, in 42 and 43, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in these tight formations of hundreds of bombers at a time could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. But unfortunately and sadly, that was not the case in the early years of the war. These bomber formations could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they took devastating losses in the early years, especially 1943. Although they implemented a mission limit of 25 in April of 43. So if a guy completed 25 missions, he could go home. It was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions that year. The average number of missions flown was only 6. And these missions were just incredibly dangerous. And it was dangerous from the time they took off and the time they landed. Because on the day of a mission, you could have hundreds of bombers all taking off from these bases at the same time. And back then, there wasn't any air traffic control or radar, and usually the weather was socked in, and they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. And so mid-air collisions were not uncommon at all. And then it took them about an hour to 2 hours for all these planes to form up before they could even head across the English Channel. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen. Or after a couple of minutes, a guy would pass out and he could die. It was also extremely cold at the altitude that they were flying. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem. And one of my dad's waist gunners was in the hospital for 2.5 months because of the seriousness of his frostbite injuries. Wow. And then they had to deal, the next thing they dealt with was the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. That Germany had stations set up along the radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bombers were coming, and they'd send up their air force to intercept them. And then when they neared the target and started their bomb run, they had to deal with anti-aircraft fire called FLAC. FLAC was an abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And these anti-aircraft cannons were deadly weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and the shells were calibrated to explode at the same altitude these bombers were flying.
Right.
And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal that could easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. And then once they got through the bomb run, the bombers that made it through would try to form up again and head back to their bases in England, where once again they'd have to face enemy fighters. And then even when they did get back to England, they faced all kinds of dangers. They could be running out of fuel. The weather could be socked in. They couldn't even find their bases to land. They could have dead or injured pilots on board. The plane could have a lot of battle damage, engines out, flight control shot out. So that resulted in a lot of crash landings where more airmen lost their lives. So flying combat was just brutal.
Yeah. And One of the things I want to draw attention to, and this was the point that I really appreciated in the book. I actually did a fist pump when I read it. All right. In the early years of the air war, the fighter aircraft, the single and twin engine aircraft, they called them little friends, that accompanied the bombers, were limited in their range because they could only carry so much fuel. And the Luftwaffe, they hung back because they knew that eventually the little friends were going to have to pull off and go back to England and refuel. And here's the part in your book. This is on page 119. It's a heading, a long-range fighter, finally. And you talk about the addition of the wing tanks on the P-51. Steve, I think this is one of the turning points in the war. I really do.
Well, the P-51s, they won the air war over Europe. You know, they came right at the very end of 43, 1944. But finally, these bomber formations had, you know, fighters that could escort them all the way deep into Germany to the target and all the way back to their bases. You know, by the time D-Day rolled around on June 6th, the P-51s had just decimated the Luftwaffe, and they were just a shell of themselves. And, you know, the Allies did have air superiority, so they were able to, you know, make the invasion.
Yeah. I think this little invention, I call it little because little things can be a turning point, but these were like paper mache cardboard tanks. They held 100 gallons of fuel, and they were the fuel that was used first. And when the P-51s encountered the German Luftwaffe, they would drop their tanks and off they would go and engage the Germans. I just thought it was brilliant.
And another thing at the time where the P-51s came in January of 44, that's when Jimmy Doolittle took over command of the 8th Air Force. And he told them, you know, not only, you know, once he almost used the bombers as bait, because he said, you know, go after these, just don't defend the bombers, but to go after the German fighters, you know, in the air, on the ground, anywhere. So these P-51s, they would follow these German fighters back to their bases. And, you know, as they're landing, they would shoot them down, or they'd shoot planes that were, you know, on the airfield, the German airfields. So they just went after the Luftwaffe, you know, with just viciously.
Guns blazing, right. Okay, tell us about what happened to your dad on his 8th mission.
Okay, it was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany, where they dropped their bomb successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak, and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane, and they lost airspeed, and they fell behind the bomber formations, you know, heading back to their bases in England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters. And like wolves or lions on prey, they came in for the kill. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those Focke-Wulf fighters were shot down as well. You know, one was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. His plane crashed and he was killed in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. And then two of the B-17 had a 10-man crew, four officers, first pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and bombardier, and then six enlisted men who were mainly gunners. And two of the men were killed in the plane. The other eight bailed out successfully. And then the first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down. And then the second half of the book is all about what happened to those guys that bailed out afterwards.
So tell us what happens to your dad.
He was the last one to bail out. In fact, my dad and the plane came down in Belgium, just north of the French border, and the other guys that bailed out actually came down in France, and then were brought back across the border into Belgium, either by the French resistance or by the Germans who captured him. But after my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees right at the French-Belgian border, and his parachute got hung up in the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple of Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvin, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. My dad came down. It was early afternoon. They helped him down from the tree, but they told him to stay put and hide because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight with German patrols combing the area looking for these guys that had bailed out. So that night they took him, went back and got him, took him that to the Dravan home. But he only stayed there one night because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that, again, with those German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgium customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle to take my dad to a safer location. And then after that, he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there.
Right.
And how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. The Belgian people who hid my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends. Because of the German secret police, the Gestapo found out about it. They would be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the people who helped my dad, you know, did meet that fate.
Wow.
So he owed them his life. He said they would let him sleep in their beds. They'd sleep on the floor. You know, food was all rationed by the Germans. So it was, you know, not a lot of food to be had, but they would give him, you know, a larger portion of their food. And, you know, they just could not do enough for my dad and these airmen that were, you know, fighting to liberate their country.
So how does he eventually work his way back?
Well, it was very stressful and frustrating for him being hidden. Normally, when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get him back through back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, right, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong. Trying to get him into a network. They were compromised, or, you know, German infiltrators would come in, or people would be killed. And yeah, and also, you know, it was stressful because he was had several close calls that are described in the book of almost being discovered by the Germans. And finally, he got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allies landed at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th of 44. And he decided to get in the fight. Unlike most airmen, before he went into the Air Force, he was in the Army for a year in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. And then he decided to join the French Resistance, which is
an unbelievable
decision. I don't think I would have done it, or very few people would have done it, because it was so dangerous. You know, fighting against the Germans, he could just be shot and killed, or if they captured him, he'd be executed on the spot as a terrorist. The logical thing for him to do, and the safest thing, was just to stay hidden and hunker down and wait for the U.S. armies to come up through France after D-Day and be liberated. But he felt, you know, there were Americans fighting and dying for their country and fight for freedom. And he thought it was his duty and job to get back into the fight. And so he talked into one of his Belgium helpers, Amy Cools, who accompanied him on bicycles over the border into France, and he joined a unit of the French Resistance called the Mackie. And they were a small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France, and their job was to harass the Germans. They had disrupt communication, sabotage railroad lines, assassinate German officers, attack German convoys, and they got their information and directions from the British through coded messages over the BBC. And my dad said that the information they gave was unbelievably accurate. If they said a German convoy was coming down this road on this date at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code.
I was just going to say,
The Germans were up to.
Yeah.
And then they were also supplied by the British through airdrops as well. And so there's various encounters in the book that the resistance group had attacking German convoys that are pretty exciting. And then finally, 7 months after he was shot down, word came down that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into the village, went up to an army major, actually it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day, and identified himself there and interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. And then he caught a ride on a convoy or taking German prisoners to Paris. And then from there, he hopped on a transport to get back to his base in England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying he was back at base, fit as a fiddle, and banked the money, honey. And he had all that back pay coming to him.
Yeah.
And so his adventure of missing in action for 7 months came to an end.
Wow, that must have been so tough.
It was really tough on my mom because
That's what I mean. Yeah.
My dad's plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And then my other sister, Nancy, was born while he was missing in action. So my mom's back in Pasadena, California, with a little 1 year old Susan and an infant Nancy, and not knowing if she'd ever see her husband again.
Right. Right. So, Steve, what was it like to research all of this, to actually live it as you're researching it?
Oh, it was pretty incredible. You know, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history, but it wasn't until I retired from my career job in 2009 that I had the time to really delve into my dad's history in more detail. And my parents had kept a lot of material from the war year, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and learn some more details. I had absolutely no intention of writing a book. But there's two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. That's absolutely riveting. I mean, he could have been a writer. And then the other thing was all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before he was shot down. And, I knew about these letters for years and years and years, but they just sat in a box.
Yeah.
And when I started going through theirs, reading them one day, I was just blown away because my dad was so candid in these letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like in the air base, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew, and it felt like I was right there with him. You know, most guys who wrote home, all they said was, it's cold over here, the food is lousy, but I'm safe. You know, how are things at home? And that was it. And so I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew. And then I just started doing all this research. And I was so fortunate that I had so much information, not only from my dad, but other members of his crew that survived. And in all the, war declassified documents for overall, they were all decent classified. So you could go on the internet and get these, bomb group diaries, squadron diaries, and all this information and learn more, all mission reports about all my dad's missions. But I couldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen, Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot. They were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it because they saw firsthand atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people, members of the Belgium underground, about events involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a huge debt. Dr. Delahaye has since died. He died in 2013. But Jacques Lalot is still living. And I've been to Belgium six times doing research, and I'm going over this, at the end of the month, for my seventh trip with my family to attend the 80th anniversary celebrations of the liberation of Belgium and ceremonies to honor my dad and his crew. There are several memorials that have been erected in the area that they'll have ceremonies at. So I can't wait to do that again. They're just wonderful and fabulous events.
Yeah. One of the stories you talk about in the book and in the the documentary is you actually met the man who shot your father down. How did you ever do that?
Yeah, that was, you know, all my dad knew, all the Air Force knew, is that they were shot down by two German Focke-Wulf fighters. And that's all I thought I'd ever know. But one day my wife says, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I'm thinking, oh, gosh. She has no idea what she's talking about. You know, she's a naive woman, and it'd be impossible. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And, you know, amazingly, I found Hans Berger. And it wasn't impossible. Actually, it ended up being very easy. You know, I went on the internet, Google, trying to find a Luftwaffe pilot. A couple forums came up that I joined, and I put inquiries on the forums because I knew the day my dad was shot down, the time of day we shot down, the location where he was shot down. In a week, two guys got back to me, one from England, one from Belgium. And on that day, there were 12 B-17 shot down, and the one shot down south of Chimay, Belgium, just north of the French border, was shot down by Hans Berger. And the guy in Belgium that contacted me was a Luftwaffe historian, had written a number of books about the Luftwaffe, and knew Hans. He was in some of his books. And so he told me Hans spoke, you know, became a translator after the war. So he spoke perfect English. So it was just incredible. So he asked Hans if it was okay if I contacted him. And he said, yeah. And so for the book, I just interviewed him over the through the telephone and over email. And I just bombarded him with questions. I was so excited about finding this guy. And because he was, you know, he's at one point in history, his path crossed paths with my dad, and he's exactly part of my dad's story. And so it was just wonderful finding Hans. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. And then on two occasions after, when on my trips to Belgium, I went to Munich, Germany to meet with him personally at his apartment and go out to lunch. And we became friends. I had hoped to go visit him one last time, you know, this year. But unfortunately, he died in January, on January 20th, just, you know, a few months ago at age 100. So
wow,
I won't be able to see him.
So how did this whole, the research that you did, what you learned about your dad, I can ask, how did it change you? But I guess it's really, how did it impact you? What's Steve like today that he wasn't like when, you know, before you started the research?
That's a good question. I just gained such an appreciation for what these guys went through, you know, these combat crews in the 8th Air Force. Because, you know, I read books and stuff, but when I really got into it, it's just, you know, they would just go up in these planes day after day, or mission after mission. It wasn't every day, you know, not knowing if that would be their last mission, and that their odds of survival were, you know, being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the entire U.S. military during World War II. They lost 26,000 men who were killed, more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. So I just gained a much greater appreciation. I got to know my dad's crew, you know, much better, you know, learning their personal lives. And so I got a closer appreciation for the crew. I went on a quest, and I found relatives of all my dad's crew and asked them for information, any information they could give me about their relatives. And many of them have gone over to Belgium for these celebration. I've got to know them. So it's kind of a Susan Ruth, you know, crew family. And then just a much better appreciation for my dad, what he went through, you know, being shot down, you know, missing in action for 7 months, hiding, being hidden, fighting with the French resistance. You know, I don't know, the guts he had is just amazing.
Right.
And better appreciation for just the whole, you know, to me, the greatest generation. and how the U.S. came together and just rallied, not only the guys who went to war, but the entire civilian population who just joined together and, fought the war in any way they could, to save aluminum or rubber and grow these victory gardens and support the war effort. And it writing the book totally changed my life. I was just a re retiree, reading books, taking naps, going for walks, and after writing this book, it's a whole new career. I'm really involved with the 306 Bomb Group. I'm also on the board of directors of the 8th Air Force Historical Society.
Georgia,
As I mentioned earlier, I go all around the United States, basically trying to educate people and about the air war over Europe and what these guys went through, so people have a better appreciation of it, especially trying to reach the younger generations, which is very difficult. But it's just my passion to keep the memory alive of these guys. And it's just what I work. I do this every day. I'm on the social media for hours every
I
day.
see you there.
And it's just really my life's work.
Steve, before the 909 was lost, before that crashed, I actually flew in that plane because I wanted to feel what it was like. But and that was special. But what I really liked seeing was on the tarmac when the plane was just sitting there, how many dads had their sons with them or their daughters with them, and they were taking them through the plane, as a way to expose them to the history.
Yeah, that was so unfortunate. I've went up in the 909 a couple of times. In fact, I knew the pilot who lived in Seal Beach, the same town that I live in, and the that was the the plane was owned by the Collins Foundation, and their the tour were called the Wings of Freedom Tour, and they sold my book on their tour stops, so I would hook up with them occasionally at very various regional airports and sign copies of my book, and I love those weekends, just sitting at my signing table and watching, like you said, all the people coming, the vets, it's bringing back memories to the vets who came, and then all the families who came, and showing their kids and going through the planes. Yeah, it was just a wonderful experience, and obviously it was a complete tragedy. What happened there in Connecticut with the 909 going down, and now the tour, the Wings of Freedom tour, is no more.
Steve, I'm sure you've been to the American Air Museum in England.
Oh yeah.
There's a beautiful memorial there, and I won't do it justice, but there's a series of glass panels outside, and they have etched in the panels images of bombers and fighter planes and what have you, all the planes that were shot down. And these panels seemingly go on forever. To your point, 30 some thousand guys died as part of the 8th Air Force. So that was a powerful exhibit.
Yes. In fact, a couple the executive director and the curator from the American Air Museum is coming to our 8th Air Force Historical Society reunion in New Orleans in September. But I've been to Duxford at the American Air Museum there, and it's a wonderful research website too that you can go on and search for 8th Air Force veterans, aircraft, and a lot of it, a lot of information. Yeah, that's a wonderful, well, it's a huge museum with all those huge hangars they have. The Cambridge American Cemetery is very moving too.
Powerful.
It's not too far away. And in Thurlow, there's a little 306 Bomb Group museum there, which is very nice to go visit. In fact, there's a pub just a couple miles from the Thurlow, where the airfield was in Bledsoe, called the Falcon Pub, where my dad went to drink with his other officer buddies, and where they drank the night before they were shot down. So, you know, I've been there a couple of times, you know, and had some pints, you know, where my dad used to drink.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Very cool. You mentioned pub. You've undoubtedly heard the story of Ye Olde Pub, the B-17. Ye Olde
What's
Pub.
What's that?
It's a B-17 called Ye Olde Pub, and it was on its second mission. It was piloted by a guy named Charlie Brown, and it got severely damaged.
Oh, yeah.
And coming back, the machine guns in the back of the plane were actually dropped, which, as I understand it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that's kind of a signal of almost surrender, but it's a signal that we're not going to engage in combat. Now, I don't know if the man, the tail gunner, was killed or not, but the German pilot who had severely damaged the plane saw that, and instead of shooting it down, he nursed it back to the English Channel. He flew with it.
Right. That was Franz Stigler.
That's correct. Right.
Yeah. And the book is called A Higher Call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he, like you met the person who shot your dad down, those two met. That's an incredible story.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The tail gunner was killed.
Okay. All right. Steve, anything that we haven't talked about that you want to mention?
I'll mention these ceremonies that they have in Belgium. Even today, the Belgian people are so grateful and so thankful for the Americans and allies coming to rescue them from 4 years of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations. As I mentioned, they've erected Paul Delahaye. Formed the Belgium American Foundation in 1984 to start erecting these memorials to honor and remember events that took place during World War II. And they have ceremonies on the anniversary dates of those events. That, like, there's a Susan Ruth Memorial and near where my dad's plane went down. But the big ceremonies are all around September 2nd, which is the anniversary of the liberation of that area. And they last several days. Well, this year they're going to last 4 days. And they have all these ceremonies at various memorials. And they set up these big tents where they have lunches and band concerts and dances and dinners. And the local beer chamay just flows. And they have this, all these, you know, U.S. Army reenactors, and they set up a U.S. Army camp, and they have a vehicle parade, and all the local villagers come out, hundreds and hundreds of people. The U.S. ambassador to Belgium comes down with his entourage, and they're just wonderful events and so moving. But I just want to, you know, point out that not only the Belgian people, but all the people in these occupied countries, the Netherlands and France, they realize what it was like to lose your freedoms and have no freedoms for 4 years. You know, in the U.S., we just take it for granted because we've always had these freedoms. We just, you know, we don't think anything about them. But those people in the occupied countries and even in England, you know, realize, because they were so close to losing their freedoms. It's just wonderful. And it's just sad that we don't have that feeling as much as we should in the United States.
Exactly. Yes. I'm going over to France next year sometime for a tour of World War I battlefields where the Americans fought. But I want to pinpoint where your dad went down and see if I can't get over there.
Well, if you're going over World War I, you have to go to Belgium too.
I know. And I was just in Belgium 2 years ago. I was researching the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest, which was one of the worst defeats of the U.S. Army in history. And I didn't know about your book at the time, or I would have checked things out. But I'll get back over there.
Yeah, because, you know, as I mentioned, all the shot down story takes place, you know, just north of the French border.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, and I'll hook you up with some people that will take you around and show you all the memorials and, you know,
oh, excellent.
Give you a little tour.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, so you're just not wandering around on your own.
All right. So I always open and close with questions of curiosity. I got to ask you the first one. You get to ask me something to finish up.
Well, how and why did you start this podcast?
Oh, yeah. The podcast is 7 years old, and I started it with a colleague. At the time, we were both working, or we had worked for an educational publishing company, and we were both interested in change, how to help organizations and individuals change. That was the first iteration, and had nothing to do with history or anything like that. It was really about helping organizations change. And then we co-wrote a book together about how schools can change. And that was the second iteration. And we did 2 years of episodes on that. And then she had to quit because she was doing so well in her private practice. She couldn't devote any time to it. And I was in the early stages of retirement. So I put us into a third iteration, Cultivating Curiosity, because there are so many subjects I'm interested in. And the podcast for the last 3 years has been very eclectic. I mean, I rarely do the same type of story twice. If I cover education, I'm not going to cover it for another month or so, you know, and I've done a couple of stories on history. I love doing stories on science. And it's something that keeps me active. So that's basically the story.
Well, that's good. And I have to point this out, because I see in the background on your shelf that you have a Toby mug.
Oh, I've got the little one. I don't have the big. I'll include a picture of that so people know what we're talking about. But
this is from the movie 12 O'Clock High.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I love that. Yeah,
I noticed that.
Yeah. All right, Steve, this has been delightful. And thank you for doing what you're doing, keeping the history alive and helping to educate younger generations on what happened over there and what, as, you know, to your point, what these young men gave, you know, it's these were often kids, 18, 19, 20 year olds that were doing this. And if you've ever, I'm sure, you know, you saw this, you felt this when you walked through a B-17, and I just marvel at what they were able to do in those cramped spaces. And anyway, it's, they gave the ultimate for, you know, for us. So thank you.
Yeah. We thank them. Like you say, they were just, a lot of those guys are just right out of high school.
Right. All right. Keep doing what you're doing. And
keep doing what you're doing.
and maybe we can touch base sometime. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Jeff here with my one takeaway. I was initially drawn to Steve's book about his father's experiences during World War II because of my deep interest in World War II aviation. But my interest was deepened when Steve spoke about his unending curiosity about his father's life.
You know, because most, you know, kids grow up, or people grow up, and, you know, they're little kids, you know, you're in your own worlds, and, you know, your parents are these old people. And then, you know, you get older and you're going to college, and then you get married and you have kids, you get a job, and you're busy, busy, busy. And most people never know really about their grandparents or their parents, you know, their earlier lives. They don't know their history. And to me, that's just fascinating. And, you know, more people should talk to their parents and their grandparents and ask them about, you know, their lives and their history.
Steve's experience here parallels my own. I had so many questions about my dad's life when he entered hospice, but by then it was too late to ask him. And I only found out about my mother's traumatic past when she was on the cusp of Alzheimer's. I'm curious, what came to mind about your parents' past as you listened to Steve's story? Are there any holes in your understanding of their early lives? Anything that would prevent you from connecting the dots to your own life, adding critical color and information about why you developed as you did? If you're curious, don't wait like Steve and I did. Ask. Talk with you next week.